away. Are you my mother? I'm finally able to ask. You already know the answer to that, Miss Saiki says. She's right. I do know the answer. But neither one of us can put it into words. Putting it into words will destroy any meaning. A long time ago, I threw away something I shouldn't have, she says. Something I loved more than anything else. I was afraid that someday I'd lose it. So I had to let it go myself. If it was going to be stolen from me, or I was going to lose it by accident, I decided it was better to discard it myself. Of course, I felt anger that didn't fade. That was part of it. But the whole thing was a huge mistake. I should never have thrown it away. I listen in silence. You were discarded by the very one who never should have done that, Miss Saiki says. Kafka, do you forgive me? Do I have the right to? She looks at my shoulder and nods several times. As long as anger and fear don't prevent you. Miss Saiki, if I really do have the right to, then yes, I do forgive you, I tell her. Mother, you say, I forgive you. And with those words, audibly, the frozen part of your heart dissolves. Silently she lets go of me. She takes the hairpin out of her hair and without a moment's hesitation stabs the sharp tip into the flesh of the inside of her left arm hard. With her right hand, she presses tightly on a vein and blood begins to seep out. The first drop plops audibly to the floor. Without a word, she holds her arm out towards me. Another drop of blood falls to the floor. I bend over and put my lips on the small wound, lick her blood with my tongue, close my eyes and savor the taste. I hold the blood in my mouth and slowly swallow it. Her blood goes down, deep in my throat. It's quietly absorbed by the dry outer layer of my heart. Only now do I understand how much I've wanted that blood. My mind is someplace far away, though my body is still right here, just like a living spirit. I feel like sucking down every last drop of blood from her, but I can't. I take my lips off her arm and look into her face. Farewell, Kafka Tamara, Miss Saiki says. Go back to where you belong. And live. Miss Saiki, I say. Yes. I don't know what it means to live. She lets me go and looks up at me. She reaches out to touch my lips. Look at the painting, she says softly. Keep looking at the painting. Just as I did. And she leaves. She opens the door and without a backward glance goes out and shuts the door. I stand at the window and watch her go. She vanishes in the shadow of a building. Hands resting on the sill, I gaze for the longest time at where she disappeared. Maybe she forgot something she wanted to say and will come back. But she never does. All that's left is an absence that's like a hollow space. The dozing bee wakes up and buzzes around me for a while. Then, as if finally remembering what it should be doing, it flies out of the open window. The sun shines down. I go back to the table and sit down. Her cup is sitting there, with a bit of tea left in it. I leave it where it is without touching it. The cup looks like a metaphor. A metaphor of memories that, before long, will be lost. I take off my shirt and change back into my sweaty, smelly T-shirt. I put the dead watch back on my left wrist. Then I put the cap Oshima gave me on backwards, and the pair of sky-blue sunglasses. Finally, I tug on my long-sleeved shirt. I walk to the sink and down a glass of tap water, put the glass in the sink, and take a final look around the room. At the dining table, the chairs. The chair the girl and Miss Saiki sat on. The teacup on the table. I close my eyes and take a deep breath. You already know the answer to that. I open the door, go outside, and close the door. I walk down the porch steps, my shadow falling distinct and clear on the ground. It looks as if it's clinging to my feet. The sun's still high in the sky. At the entrance to the forest, the two soldiers are leaning against a tree trunk, as though they've been waiting for me. When they see me, they don't ask a single question. It's as if they already know what I'm thinking. Their rifles are slung over their shoulders. The tall soldier is chewing on a stalk of grass. The entrance is still open, he says. At least it was when I checked a minute ago. You don't mind if we keep the same pace as before? The brawny one asks. You can keep up. No problem. I can keep up. It'll be a problem, though, if we get there and the entrance is already shut, the tall one says. Then you're stuck here, his companion adds. I know, I say. No regrets at having to leave? The tall one asks. None. Then let's get going. Better not look behind you, the brawny one says. Yeah, that's a good idea, the tall one says. And once again, I set off through the forest. Once, as we're hurrying up a slope, I do glance back. The soldiers warned me not to, but I couldn't help it. This is the last place you can see the town from. Beyond it, we'll be cut off by a wall of trees, and that world will vanish from my sight forever. There still isn't a soul along the way. A beautiful stream runs through the hollow. Small buildings line the street, and electric poles at set intervals cast dark shadows on the ground. For a moment, I'm frozen to the spot. I have to go back, no matter what. I could at least stay there until evening, when the young girl with the canvas bag will visit me. If you need me, I'll be there. I get a hot lump in my chest, and a powerful magnet's pulling me back towards the town. My feet are buried in lead and won't budge. If I go on, I'll never see her again. I come to a halt. I've lost all sense of time. I want to call out to the soldiers in front of me. I'm not going back. I'm staying. But no voice comes out. Words have no life in them. I'm caught between one void and another. I have no idea what's right, what's wrong. I don't even know what I want anymore. I'm standing alone in the middle of a horrific sandstorm. I can't move, and can't even see my fingertips. I can't move. Sand as white as pulverized bones wraps me in its grip. But I hear her, Miss Saiki, speaking to me. You still have to go back, she is saying decisively. It's what I want, for you to be there. The spell is broken, and I'm in one piece again. Warm blood returns to my body, the blood she gave me, the last drops of blood she had. The next instant, I'm facing forward and hurrying after the soldiers. I turn a corner, and that little world in the hills is gone, swallowed up in dreams. Now I just focus on making it through the forest without getting lost, not straying from the path. That's what's important now, what I have to do. The entrance is still open. There's still time until evening. I thank the two soldiers. They lay down their rifles and, like before, sit on the large flat rock. The tall soldier's still chewing on a bit of grass. They're not out of breath at all after our breathless rush through the woods. Don't forget what I told you about bayonets, the tall soldier says. When you stab the enemy, you've got to twist and slash to cut open his guts. Otherwise, he'll do it to you. That's the way the world is out there.
That's not all there is, though, the brawny one says.
No, of course, the tall one replies and clears his throat.
I'm just talking about the dark side of things. It's also really hard to tell right from wrong, the brawny one says.
But it's something you've got to do, the tall one adds.
Most likely, the brawny one says.
One more thing, the tall one says. Once you leave here, don't look back until you reach your destination. Not even once, do you understand?
This is important, the brawny one adds.
Somehow you made it through back there, the tall one says. But this time, it's serious. Until you get to where you're going, don't ever look back.
Ever, the brawny one says.
I understand, I tell them. I thank them again and say goodbye.
The two of them come to attention and salute.
I'll never see them again. I know that, and they know that. And knowing this, we bid each other farewell. I don't recall much of how I got back to Orshima's cabin after leaving the soldiers. As I made my way through the thick forest, my mind must have been elsewhere. Amazingly, I didn't get lost. I have a vague memory of spotting the rucksack I'd thrown away and, without thinking, picking it up. Same with the compass, the hatchet, the can of spray paint. I remember seeing the yellow marks I'd sprayed on tree trunks, like scales left behind by some giant moth. I stand in the clearing in front of the cabin and gaze up at the sky. The world around me is suddenly filled with brilliant sounds. Birds chirping, water gurgling down the stream, wind rustling the leaves. All faint, but to me, it's as if corks had been pulled from my ears, and now everything sounds so alive, so warm, so close. Everything's mixed together. But still, I can make out each individual sound. I look down at the watch on my wrist and it's working again. Digital numbers flash on the green screen, changing each minute, like nothing had ever happened. It's 4:16. I go into the cabin and lie on the bed in my clothes. I'm exhausted. I lie there on my back and close my eyes. A bee is resting above the window. The girl's arms glisten in the sunlight like porcelain. An example, she says. Look at the painting, Miss Saiki said. Just as I did. White sands of time slip through the girl's slim fingers. Waves crash softly against the shore. They rise up, tumble, and break. Rise up. Tumble and break. And my consciousness is sucked into a dim, dark corridor.
48. Give me a break, Hoshino repeated.
Nothing's about to break here, Mr. Hoshino, the black cat said wearily. The cat had a large face and looked old. I thought you were bored all by yourself, talking to a stone all day. But how can you speak human language? I can't. I don't get it. How are we able to carry on a conversation like this, a human and a cat? We're on the border of this world, speaking a common language. That's all.
Hoshino gave this some thought.
The border of the world? A common language? It's all right if you don't understand. I could explain, but it's a long story, the cat said, giving a couple of short, dismissive flips of its tail. Hang on a sec, Hoshino said. You're Colonel Sanders, aren't you?
Colonel who? The cat said sullenly. I don't know who you're talking about. I'm me and nobody else. Just your friendly neighborhood cat.
Do you have a name?
Of course I do.
What is it?
Toro, the cat replied hesitantly.
Toro? Hoshino repeated. Like the real expensive part of tuna, you mean?
Correct, the cat replied. The local sushi chef owns me. They have a dog, too. They call him Teka. tuna roll. How do you know my name, then? You're pretty famous, Mr. Hoshino, Toro replied and smiled.
Hoshino had never seen a cat smile before. The smile quickly faded, though, and the cat went back to its usual docile expression.
Cats know everything, Toro said. I know that Mr. Nakata died yesterday, and that there's a valuable stone over there. I've lived a long life and know everything that's happened around here.
Oshino murmured, impressed. Instead of us shooting the breeze out here, why don't you come inside, Toro? Lying on the railing, the cat shook its head.
No, I'm fine here. I wouldn't be able to relax inside. Besides, it's a nice day out, so why don't we just talk here?
Fine by me, Oshino said. Say, are you hungry? I'm sure we have something to eat. Again, the cat shook his head.
Thanks, but I'm all set for food. In fact, keeping my weight down's more of a problem.
If your owner runs a sushi shop, you tend to have a bit of a cholesterol problem. Jumping up and down's hard when you're carrying some excess pounds.
Well, tell me then, Toro, is there some reason you're here?
There is, the black cat said.
I thought you might be having a hard time dealing with that stone all alone.
You got that right. Definitely. I'm in kind of a fix here.
I thought I'd lend you a hand.
That would be great, Hoshino said. Take a pause in your schedule, eh?
The stone's the problem, Toro said, shaking its head to get rid of a buzzing fly. Once you get the stone back the way it belongs, your job's over. You can go wherever you want after that. Do I have that right?
Yep, you got it. Once I get the stone closed, that's it, finished. As Mr. Nakata once said, once you open something up, you got to close it. That's the rule.
That's why I thought I'd show you what to do.
You know what I should do? Hoshino asked, excited.
Of course, the cat said. What did I tell you? Cats know everything, not like dogs.
So what should I do?
You have to kill it, the cat said soberly.
Kill it?
Hoshino said. That's right. You've got to kill it.
Who is this it you're talking about?
You'll know it when you see it, the black cat explained. Until you actually see it, though, you won't understand what I mean. It doesn't have any real form to begin with. It changes shape depending on the situation.
Is this a person we're talking about?
No, it's no person. That's for certain.
So what does it look like?
You got me, Toro said. Didn't I just explain that you'll know it when you see it, and if you don't, you won't? What is it about that that you don't understand?
Hoshino sighed. So what is this thing's real identity?
You don't need to know that, the cat said. It's not easy to explain. Or maybe I should say you're better off not knowing. Anyhow, right now it's biding its time, lying in some dark place, breathing calmly, watching and waiting. But it's not going to wait forever. Sooner or later it'll make its move. My guess is today's the day, and it will most definitely pass in front of you. It's an opportune moment.
Opportune? A one-in-a-million chance, the black cat said. All you have to do is wait and kill it. That will put an end to the affair. Then you're free to go wherever you like.
Isn't that against the law? I wouldn't know about the law, the cat said, being a cat. Since it's not a person, though, I doubt the law has anything to do with it. Anyhow, it's got to be killed. Even your typical cat next door, like me, can see that.
Okay, say I want to kill it. How am I supposed to do it? I don't have any idea how big it is or what it looks like. Hard to plan a murder when you don't know the basic facts about the victim.
It's up to you. Smash it with a hammer, if you like. Stab it with a carving knife. Strangle it, burn it, bite it to death. Whatever works for you. But the main thing is, you've got to kill it. Liquidate it with extreme prejudice. You were in the self-defense force, am I right? Used taxpayers' money to learn how to shoot a rifle, how to sharpen a bayonet. You're a soldier, so use your head and work out the best way to kill it.
What I learned in the SDF was what to do in a war, Hoshino protested weakly. They never trained me to ambush and kill something whose size and shape I don't even know, with a hammer, no less.
It'll be trying to get in through the entrance, Toro went on, ignoring Hoshino's protests. But you can't let it, no matter what. You've got to make sure you kill it before it gets inside the entrance. Got it? Let it slip by you, and that's the end.
A one in a million chance.
Exactly, Toro said, though that's just a figure of speech.
But isn't this thing pretty dangerous? Hoshino asked fearfully. It might turn the tables on me.
It's probably not all that dangerous when it's on the move, the cat said. Once it stops moving, though, watch out. That's when it's dangerous. So when it's on the move, don't let it get away. That's when you've got to finish it off.
Probably,
Hoshino said. The black cat didn't reply to that. He narrowed his eyes, stretched on the railing, and slowly got to his feet.
I'll be seeing you, Mr. Hoshino. Remember to kill it. If you don't do it, Mr. Nakata will never rest in peace. You liked the old man, didn't you?
Yeah, he was a good man.
So you have to kill it. Obliterate it with extreme prejudice, as I said. Mr. Nakata would have wanted you to. So do it for him. You've taken on his role now. You've always been a happy-go-lucky type, never taking responsibility for anything, right? Now's the chance to make up for that. Don't blow it, okay? I'll be rooting for you.
That's encouraging, Hoshino said.
Oh, hey, I just thought of something.
What?
Maybe the entrance stone is still open to lure it in.
Could be, Toro said diffidently. One more thing. It only makes a move very late at night. You should sleep during the day to make sure you don't fall asleep late and let it get away. That would be a catastrophe.
The black cat leapt nimbly onto the roof next door, straightened its tail, and walked away. For such a huge cat, it was light on its feet. Hoshino watched from the veranda as the cat disappeared. Toro didn't look back even once.
Man alive, Hoshino said, then went back into the kitchen to scout around for potential weapons.
He found an extremely sharp kitchen knife, plus another heavy knife shaped like a hatchet. There was only a rudimentary assortment of pots and pans, but quite a collection of knives. In addition, he found a big, heavy hammer and some nylon rope. An ice pick rounded out his arsenal.
This is where a nice automatic rifle would come in handy, he thought as he rummaged around the kitchen.
He'd been trained to shoot automatic rifles in the SDF and was a decent marksman. Not that he expected to find a rifle in a cupboard somewhere. If anybody ever fired an automatic rifle in a quiet neighborhood like this, they'd be hell to pay. He laid all his weapons out on the living room table. The two knives, ice pick, hammer and rope. He laid a torch beside them. Then he sat down next to the stone and began rubbing it.
Jeez, Hoshino said to the stone. A hammer and knives to fight something, and I don't even know what it is. With a black cat from the neighborhood calling the shots. What the hell kind of a deal is this?
The stone, of course, withheld comment.
Toro said it probably wasn't dangerous. Probably. But what if something out of Jurassic Park springs up? What the hell am I supposed to do then, eh? I'd be a goner.
No response. Hoshino took the hammer and swung it around a few times.
If you think about it, it's all fate. From the moment I picked up Mr. Nakata at the rest area till now, it's as if fate decided everything. The only one who hasn't had a clue has been me. Fate is one strange thing, my friend, Hoshino said. Right? What's your take on it?
The stone maintained its stony silence.
Well, what's a man to do, eh? I'm the one who chose this path, and I've got to see it through to the end. Kind of hard to imagine what repulsive thing's going to pop out. But I'm okay with that. Got to give it my best shot. Life's short, and I've had some good times. Toro said this is a one-in-a-million chance. Maybe it wouldn't be so bad to go out in a blaze of glory. At least try to win one for the old guy. For Mr. Nakata.
The stone's silent vigil continued. Hoshino did as the cat had told him, and took a nap on the sofa in preparation for the night. It felt strange to follow a cat's instructions, but once he did lie down, he was able to sleep soundly for an hour. In the evening, he went into the kitchen, defrosted some shrimp curry, and had it over rice. As it started to get dark, he sat down next to the stone, knives and hammer in easy reach. He turned off all the lights, except for a small table lamp. That's best, he thought. It only makes a move at night, so I might as well make it as dark as possible. I want to finish this off soon, too. So if you're out there, show your face. Let's get it over with, okay? Once we're finished here, I'm going back to Nagoya, to my apartment, and call up some girl and get it on. He no longer talked to the stone. He just waited there, silently, glancing every so often at the clock. When he got bored, he'd swing the knife and hammer around. If anything happens, he thought, it's got to be the middle of the night. But of course it might take place before that, and he wanted to make sure he didn't miss his chance. He's one in a million chance. Now wasn't the time to slack off. Every once in a while he took a bite of cracker and a sip of mineral water.
Hey, stone, Hoshino whispered. It's past midnight now, the time the demons come out, the moment of truth. Let's you and me find out what's going to happen, what you say.
He reached out to touch the stone. Maybe it was just his imagination, but the surface seemed slightly warmer than usual. He rubbed it over and over to boost his courage.
I want you to root for me too, okay? He said to the stone. I could do with a little emotional support here.
It was a little after 3 a.m. when a faint rustling noise started to come from the room where Nakata's body lay. A sound like something crawling along tatami. But there weren't any tatami because that room was carpeted. Hoshino stood up and listened closely. No mistake about it, he thought. I don't know what it is, but something's happening in there. His heart started to pound. He stuck the hammer in his belt, grabbed the sharpest knife in his right hand, the torch in his left, and stood up. Here we go, he said to no one in particular. He crept to the door to Nakata's room and opened it. He switched on the torch and played it quickly around the body. That's definitely where the rustling had come from. The beam illuminated a long, pale, thin object that was squirming out of Nakata's mouth. It reminded Hoshino of a gourd. It was as thick as a man's arm, and though he couldn't tell how long it was, Hoshino guessed that about half of it was out. Its wet body glistened like mucus. Nakata's mouth was stretched wide open like a snake's to let the thing out. His jaw must have been unhinged, it was so wide open. Hoshino gulped loudly. His hand holding the torch was trembling a little, the light wavering.
Jesus! Now how am I supposed to kill this thing? He wondered.
It didn't seem to have any arms or legs, eyes or nose. So slimy you can't get a good grip.
So how am I supposed to liquidate it? And what the hell kind of creature is it, anyway?
Was it some sort of parasite that had been hiding inside Nakata all this time?
Or was it the old man's soul? No, that can't be it.
Intuition told him that kind of creepy thing couldn't have been inside Nakata.
Even I know that much. It had to come from somewhere else, and it's going through Mr. Nakata just to get inside the entrance. It appeared when it wanted to, using Mr. Nakata as a passageway for its own purposes. And I can't let that happen. That's why I've got to kill it. As the cat said, liquidate it with extreme prejudice.
Hoshino went over to Nakata and stabbed his knife into what seemed to be the head of the creature. He pulled out the knife and stabbed again, and again, and again. But there was little resistance to the knife, just the crisp feel you get when you plunge a knife into a vegetable. Below the slimy exterior there was no firm flesh, no bones, no organs, no brain. When he pulled out the blade, the mucus covered up the wound at once. No blood or liquid oozed out. It doesn't feel a thing, Hoshino thought.
No matter how fiercely he attacked it, the thing went on, creeping out of Nakata's mouth, unaffected. Hoshino tossed the knife to the floor and went back to the living room and picked up the heavy hatchet-shaped knife. He swung it down on the white thing over and over, splitting the head open, but, just as he thought, there was nothing inside. Just the same mushy white as the outer skin. He slashed at it a few times, finally severing part of the head that squirmed like a slug on the floor for a moment, then stopped moving as if it were dead. This had no effect on the rest of the body, which continued to ooze forward. Mucus soon covered the wound, swelling up so the thing soon looked the same as before. It did not slow down. It wriggled on out of the old man's mouth. Finally, the whole creature was out, revealing its entire form. It was about a yard long, with a tail, which finally allowed Hoshino to see for sure which end was which. The tail was like a salamander's, short and thick, the tip abruptly tapering to a thin point. It had no legs, no eyes, no mouth or nose, but it most definitely had a will of its own. No, Hoshino thought, it's more as though a will is all it has. He didn't need to work that out logically, he just knew it. When it's on the move, he thought, it just happens to take on this shape. A chill ran up his spine. Come what may, he concluded, I have to kill it. He tried the hammer next, but that didn't do any good. He'd pound one part of the creature, only to see the surrounding flesh and mucus fill in the depression he'd made. He brought over a small table and began hammering the thing with one of the legs, but nothing slowed down its inexorable advance. Like some clumsy snake, it slowly, steadily crawled towards the next room and the entrance stone. This isn't like any other living creature I've ever seen, Hoshino thought. No weapon has any effect on it. There's no heart you can stab, no throat you can throttle. So what the hell can I do? This thing is evil, and no matter what, I've got to keep it from getting into the entrance. Toro said that I'd know it when I saw it, and damn if he isn't right. I can't let this thing live. Hoshino went back to the kitchen to look for something else to use as a weapon, but he couldn't find anything. And then he looked down at the stone at his feet. The entrance stone. That's it. I can use the stone to smash the thing. In the dim light, the stone had a more reddish cast to it than usual. He bent down and tried to lift it. It was terribly heavy, and he couldn't budge it an inch. I say, you're back to being the entrance stone, he said. So if I close you up before that thing gets here, it won't be able to go inside. Hoshino struggled with all his might to lift the stone, but couldn't. You're not moving, he said to the stone, gulping down big breaths. I think you're even heavier than before. You're a real ball buster, you know that? Behind him, the rustling sound went on. The white thing was steadily getting closer and closer. He didn't have much time. One more try, Hoshino said. He rested his hands on the stone, took a huge breath, filling his lungs, and held the air in. He focused all his energy on one spot and put both hands on one side of the stone. If he couldn't lift it this time, he wouldn't have a second chance. This is it, Hoshino. It's now or never. I'm going to do this if it kills me. With all the strength he could muster, he gave a deep groan as he took the strain. The stone came a few inches off the floor. He put his last ounce of energy into it and managed, as if he were tearing the stone from the floor, to lift it up. His head felt faint, and the muscles in his arms were screaming with pain. His balls felt as though they'd long since been busted. He could raise it no higher. Hoshino thought of Nakata, how the old man had given his life to open and close the stone. Somehow, some way, he had to see it through to the bitter end. Toro told him that he had to take over from the old man. His muscles were aching for fresh blood, his lungs dying for air to make that blood, but he couldn't breathe. He knew he was about as close to death as you can get, the abyss of nothingness gaping open right before his eyes. But he ignored this, focused all his strength one last time and heaved the stone towards him. It lifted up and, with a massive thud, flipped over and fell to the floor. The floor shook with the shock, the glass door rattling. The stone was tremendously, profoundly heavy. Hoshino sat there, gasping for air. You did good, he told himself a few moments later, when he had finally caught his breath.
Once he'd closed the entrance, taking care of the white object was surprisingly simple. It was shut out of where it was headed, and it knew it. It stopped its advance and started crawling around the room, looking for a place to hide, perhaps hoping to crawl back inside Nakata's mouth. But it didn't have the strength to escape. Hoshino went after it, chopping it to pieces with his hatchet. Those pieces he chopped into even tinier ones. These little bits writhed for a while on the floor, but soon lost strength and stopped moving. They curled up into tight little balls and died, the carpet glistening with their slime. Hoshino gathered all the pieces with a dustpan, dumped them in a bin bag that he tied closed with string, then put this bag inside another that he also tied up tight. This he put inside a thick cloth bag he found in the kitchen cupboard. Completely drained, he squatted on the floor, his shoulders heaving as he took deep breaths. His hands were shaking. He wanted to say something, but couldn't form the words.
You did a good job, Hoshino, he managed a few moments later.
With all the noise he'd made attacking the white creature and flipping the stone over, he was worried that people in the apartment building had woken up and were even now dialing 110. Fortunately, there were no police sirens, no one pounding on the door. The last thing he needed was for the police to come barging in. Hoshino knew that the bits and pieces of the white creature stuffed in the tightly sealed bags weren't about to come back to life.
There's no place left for them to go, he thought.
But it was a good idea to make sure, so he decided that as soon as it was light he'd go to the beach and burn them, turn them into ash. And once that was done, he'd head back to Nagoya, back home. It was nearly 4 by this time, and getting light. Time to get going. Hoshino stuffed his clothes into his bag, including, just to be on the safe side, his sunglasses and Chunichi Dragon's cap. Getting nabbed by the police before he could finish would mess up the whole thing. He took along a bottle of cooking oil to use to light the fire. He remembered his CD of the Archduke Trio and tossed it into his bag as well. Finally, he went into the room where Nakata lay in bed. The air conditioning was still on full blast, and the room was freezing.
Hey there, Mr. Nakata, he said. I'm just about ready to leave. I'm sorry, but I can't stay here forever. I'll call the police from the station so they can come and take care of your body. We'll have to leave the rest to some kind officer, okay? We'll never see each other again, but I'll never forget you. Even if I tried to, I don't think I could.
With a loud rattle, the air conditioning shut down. You know what, Gramps? He went on. I think that whenever something happens in the future, I'll always wonder, what would Mr. Nakata say about this? What would Mr. Nakata do? I'll always have someone to turn to. And that's kind of a big deal, if you think about it. It's as if part of you will always live inside me. Not that I'm the best container you could find, but better than nothing, eh? The person he was addressing, though, was no more than a shell of Mr. Nakata. The important part of him had long since left for another place. And Hoshino understood that. Hey there, he said to the stone, and reached out to touch its surface. It was back to being just an ordinary stone, cool and rough to the touch.
I'm on my way, going home to Nagoya. I'll have to let the police take care of you, too. I know I should take you back to the shrine where you came from, but my memory isn't so good and I don't have any idea which shrine it is. You'll have to forgive me. Don't put a curse on me or anything, okay? I just did what Colonel Sanders told me to. So if you're going to put a curse on anybody, he's your guy. Anyway, I'm happy I was able to meet you. I'll never forget you, either.
Hoshino put on his thick-soled Nike trainers and walked out of the apartment, leaving the door unlocked. In one hand he held his bag with all his things, in the other one the bag with that white thing's corpse.
Gentlemen,
he said, gazing up at the dawn rising in the east, it's time to light my fire.
49. Just after 9 the next morning, I hear the sound of a car approaching and go outside. It's a small, four-wheel drive Datsun truck, the kind with massive tyres, and the body jacked up high. It looks as if it hasn't been washed in at least half a year. In the back are two long, well-used surfboards. The truck grinds to a halt in front of the cabin. When the engine cuts off, silence returns. The door opens, and a tall young man climbs down, wearing an oversized white T-shirt, an oil-stained, no-fear shirt, khaki shorts, and trainers that have seen better days. The guy looks around 30, with wide shoulders. He's tanned all over and has 3 days' worth of stubble on his face. His hair's long enough to hide his ears. I'm guessing this has to be Oshima's older brother, the one who runs a surf shop in Kochi. "Hey," he says. "Morning," I reply. He sticks out his hand and we shake hands on the porch. He has a strong grip. I guessed right. He does turn out to be Oshima's older brother. "Everybody calls me Sada," he tells me. He talks slowly, choosing his words deliberately, as though he's in no hurry. Like he has all the time in the world. "I got a call from Takamatsu to come and pick you up and take you back," he explains. "Sounds as if some urgent business came up."
"Urgent business?"
"Yeah. I don't know what, though." "Sorry you had to go to all this trouble," I tell him. "No need to apologize," he says. "Can you be ready to leave soon? Give me 5 minutes." While I'm stuffing my things in my backpack, he helps me to close up the place, whistling all the while. He shuts the window, pulls the curtains, checks that the gas is off, gathers up the remaining food, does a quick scrub of the sink. I can tell from watching him that he feels like the cabin's an extension of himself.
"Seems that my brother likes you," Sada said.
"He doesn't like that many people. He's a somewhat difficult person. He's been really kind to me." Sada nods. "He can be pretty nice when he wants to be." I climb into the passenger seat of the truck and toss my backpack at my feet. Sada turns on the ignition, shifts into gear, leans out the window to check out the cabin one more time, then speeds away. "This cabin is one of the few things the two of us share as brothers," he says as he expertly maneuvers down the mountain road. "When the mood takes us, we sometimes come here and spend a few days alone." He mulls this over for a while, then goes on. "This was always an important place for the two of us, and still is. It's as though there's a power here that recharges us. A quiet sort of power. You know what I mean?"
"I think so," I tell him.
"My brother said you would," Sada says. "People that don't get it never will." The faded cloth seats are covered with white dog hair. The dog smell mixes with that of the sea, plus the scent of surfboard wax and cigarettes. The knob for the air conditioning is broken off. The ashtrays full of butts, the side pockets stuffed with random cassette tapes minus their boxes. "I went into the woods a few times," I say.
"Deep in there?"
"Yes," I reply.
"Oshima warned me not to."
"But you went in anyway."
"Yeah," I say. "I did the same once. Must be like 10 years ago."
He's silent for a time, concentrating on his driving. We're on a long curve, the thick tires spraying pebbles as we go. Every so often, there are crows beside the road. They don't try to fly away, just watch intently, with curious eyes as we pass by.
"Did you run across the soldiers?"
Sada asks, as casually as if he'd asked me what time it was.
"You mean those two soldiers?"
"Right," Sada responds, glancing at me. "You went in that far, eh?"
"Yeah, I did," I reply.
His hands lightly gripping the wheel as he maneuvers it, he doesn't respond, and his expression doesn't tell me anything.
"Sada," I ask.
"Hmm?" he says. "When you met those soldiers 10 years ago, what did you do?"
"What did I do when I met those soldiers?" he repeats.
I nod and wait for his answer. He glances in the rearview mirror, then looks ahead again.
I've never talked about that to anyone, he says. Not even to my brother. Brother, sister, whatever you want to call him. Brother works for me. He doesn't know anything about those soldiers. I nod, saying nothing. And I doubt I'll ever tell anybody about it. Even you. And I don't think you'll ever talk about it to anyone either. Even to me. You know what I'm trying to say? I think so, I tell him. What is it? It's not something you can get across in words. The real response is something words can't express. There you go, Sada replies. Exactly. If you can't get it across in words, then it's better not to try. Even to yourself, I ask. Yeah, even to yourself, Sada says. Better not to try to explain it, even to yourself. He offers me a stick of cool mint gum. I take one and start chewing. You ever try surfing? He asks. No. If you have the chance, I'll teach you, he says. If you'd like to learn, I mean. The waves are pretty decent along the Kochi shore, and there aren't too many surfers. Surfing's a more profound kind of sport than it looks. When you surf, you learn not to fight the power of nature, even if it gets violent. He takes out a cigarette from the pocket of his T-shirt, sticks it in his mouth, and lights up with the dashboard lighter. That's another thing that words can't explain. One of those things that's neither a yes or no answer. He narrows his eyes and blows smoke out of the window. In Hawaii, he goes on, there's a spot they call the toilet bowl. There are these huge whirlpools, because it's where the incoming and outgoing tides meet and crash into each other. It goes around and around, like when you flush a toilet. If you wipe out there, you get pulled underwater, and it's hard to float up again. Depending on the waves, you might never make it back to the surface. So there you are, underwater, pounded by waves, and there's nothing you can do. Flailing around's not going to get you anywhere. You'll just use up your energy. You've never been so scared in your life. But unless you get over that fear, you'll never be a real surfer. You have to face death, really get to know it, then overcome it. When you're down in that whirlpool, you start thinking about all kinds of things. It's like you get to be friends with death, have a heart-to-heart talk with it. At the gate, he gets out of the truck and locks it back up, jiggling the chain a couple of times to make sure it'll hold. After this, we don't talk much. He leaves an FM station on as he drives, but I can tell he's not really listening to it. Having the radio on's just a token gesture. Even when we go into a tunnel, and all we hear is static, he doesn't mind. With the air conditioning broken, we leave the windows open when we get on the highway. If you ever feel like learning how to surf, stop by and see me, Sada says as the inland sea comes into view. I have an extra room, and you can stay as long as you like. Thanks, I say. I'll take you up on that. I don't know when, though. You're pretty busy. I have a couple of things I have to take care of. Same with me, Sada says. We don't say anything for a long time. He's thinking over his problems. I'm thinking over mine. He keeps his eyes on the road, left hand on top of the steering wheel, and smokes the occasional cigarette. Unlike Oshima, he doesn't speed. With his elbow propped on the open window, he drives at a leisurely pace. The only time he passes other cars is when they're going much too slowly. Then he reluctantly accelerates, goes around, and slips back into his lane. Have you been surfing for a long time? I ask him. He says. And then there's silence. Finally, when I've almost forgotten the question, he answers. I've been surfing since high school. Then it was just for fun. Didn't really get serious about it till 6 years ago. I was working at a big ad agency in Tokyo. I couldn't stand it, so I quit, moved back here and started surfing. I took out a loan, borrowed some money from my parents, and opened a surf shop. I run it alone, so I can pretty much do whatever I want.
Did you want to come back to Shikoku? That was part of it, he says. I don't know. I don't feel right unless I've got the sea and mountains nearby. People are, by and large, a product of where they were born and raised. How you think and feel is always linked to the lie of the land, the temperature, the prevailing winds even. Where were you born? Tokyo. In Nogata. In Mikano Ward. Do you want to go back there? I shake my head. No. Why not? There's no reason for me to go back. Okay, he says. I'm not very connected to the lie of the land, the prevailing winds and all that, I say. Yeah, he says. We're silent again. Silence doesn't seem to bother him a bit. Or me either. I just sit there, my mind a blank, listening to the music on the radio. He's staring at the road ahead. Eventually we exit the highway, turn north, and drive into the Takamatsu city limits. It's a little before 1 p.m. when we arrive at the Komura Library. Sada drops me off in front, but he doesn't get out himself. The engine's still running, and he's going right back to Kochi. Thanks, I say. Hope we can see each other soon, he says. He sticks his hand out the window, gives a brief wave, then squeals away on his thick tires. Heading back to catch some big waves, to his own world, his own issues. I put on my backpack and pass through the gate. I catch a whiff of the freshly mown lawn in the garden. It feels as if I've been away for months, but it's only been 4 days. Oshima's at the counter, wearing a tie, something I've never seen before. A white button-down shirt and a mustard yellow and green striped tie. He's rolled the sleeves up to his elbows and doesn't have a jacket on. In front of him, predictably, there's a coffee cup and 2 neatly sharpened pencils. Hey, he greets me, adding his usual smile. Hi, I say back. I guess you caught a ride with my brother. That's right. Bet he didn't talk much, Oshima says. Actually, we did talk a little. You're lucky. Depending on who he's with, sometimes he won't say a word. Did something happen here? I ask. He told me there was something urgent. Oshima nods. There are a couple of things you need to know about. First of all, Miss Sayaki passed away. She had a heart attack. I found her collapsed face down on her desk upstairs on Tuesday afternoon. It happened all of a sudden, and it doesn't seem like she suffered. I set my pack on the floor and sit in a chair. Tuesday afternoon, I ask. Today's Friday, right? Yes, that's right. She died after the regular Tuesday tour. I probably should have got in touch with you sooner, but I couldn't think straight. Sunk back in the chair, I find I can't move. The two of us sit there in silence for a long time. I can see the stairs leading to the first floor, the well-polished black banister, the stained glass on the landing. Those stairs always held a special significance for me, because they led to her, to Miss Sayaki. But now they're just empty stairs, with no meaning at all. She's no longer there. As I mentioned before, I think this was predestined, Oshima says. I knew it, and so did she. Though when it happens, of course, it's pretty hard to take. When he pauses, I feel as though I should say something, but the words won't come. According to her wishes, there won't be a funeral, Oshima continues. She was quietly cremated. She left a will in a drawer in her desk upstairs. She left her whole estate to the foundation that runs the library. She left me her Mont Blanc pen as a keepsake, and a painting for you. The one of the boy on the shore. You'll take it, won't you? I nod. It's all wrapped up over there, ready to go. Thanks, I say, finally able to speak. Tell me something, Kafka Tamara, Oshima says. He picks up a pencil and gives it his usual twirl. Do you mind if I ask you a question? I nod. I didn't need to tell you that she died, did I? You already knew. Again, I nod. I think I did. I thought so, Oshima says, and draws a deep breath. Would you like some water or something? To tell you the truth, you look as parched as a desert. Thanks, I could use some. I am pretty thirsty, but hadn't realized it until he mentioned it. I down the iced water he brings me in a single gulp, so fast my head starts to ache. I put the empty glass back on the table. More? I shake my head. What are your plans now? Oshima asks. I'm going to go back to Tokyo, I say. What are you going to do there? Go to the police, first of all, and tell them what I know. If I don't, they'll be after me for the rest of my life. And then, I'll most likely go back to school. Not that I want to, but I have to at least finish junior high. If I just put up with it for a few months and graduate, then I can do whatever I want. Makes sense, Oshima says. He narrows his eyes and looks at me. That sounds like the best plan. More and more, I've been thinking that's the way to go. You can run, but you can't hide. Yeah, I guess so, I say. You've grown up. I shake my head. I can't say a thing. Oshima lightly taps the rubber end of a pencil against his temple a couple of times. The phone rings, but he ignores it. Every one of us is losing something precious to us, he says after the phone stops ringing. Lost opportunities, lost possibilities, feelings we can never get back again. That's part of what it means to be alive. But inside our heads, at least that's where I imagine it, there's a little room where we store those memories. A room like the stacks in this library. And to understand the workings of our own heart, we have to keep on making new reference cards. We have to dust things off every once in a while, let in fresh air, change the water in the flower vases. In other words, you'll live forever in your own private library. I stare at the pencil in his hand. It pains me to look at it. But I have to be the world's toughest 15-year-old, at least for a while longer. Or pretend to be. I take a deep breath, fill my lungs with air, and manage to inhale that lump of emotion. Is it all right if I come back here someday? I ask. Of course, Oshima says, and lays his pencil on the counter. He links his hands behind his head and looks straight at me. The word is that I'll be in charge of the library for a while, and I imagine I'll need an assistant. Once you're free of the police, school, what have you, and provided you want to, of course, I'd love to have you back. The town and I aren't going anywhere, not for the time being. People need a place they can belong. Thanks, I tell him. You're quite welcome, he says. Your brother said he'd teach me how to surf. That's great. He doesn't take to most people, he says. He's a bit of a difficult person. I nod and smile. They really are quite alike, these two brothers. Kafka, Oshima says, looking deep into my eyes. I could be wrong, but I think that's the first time I've ever seen you smile. You could be right, I say. I most definitely am smiling and blushing. When are you going back to Tokyo? Right now, I think. Can't you wait till the evening? I could drive you to the station after we close up. I consider this, then shake my head. Thanks. But I think it's best if I leave right away. Oshima nods.